Hello, everybody. This is Dane Gentry with Standing Back Up Podcast. I hope everyone's well today and blessed. And I hope that no matter what's going on in your world or in your life today, man, that you're living to your best abilities. That's what's, you know, important. Because we don't do that, especially if we're out there ripping and running and living the drug addict life. Today, I'm going to do something a little bit different, man. I'm just going to tell my story, me by myself today. I've been wanting to do this for a while and kind of. A lot of things were keeping me from doing it scheduled, just that and the other. So we're going to do that today. And so we're going to start at the beginning, man. I was born in 1975 in the big town of Nashville, Tennessee. My mother was already a single mother. I had a brother that was 6 years older than me at the time. Him and I had different dads. And the guy that got my mother pregnant was married at the time, and he was an alcoholic. And my mother had her own issues with alcohol and things as well. I mean, you know, she was 17 when she had her first baby. So as you can imagine, life just wasn't, you know, ideal. And we were very poor, you know, pretty much all most of my young life. My mother didn't have an education and them types of things. And, so life is what it, you know, what it was. My mother partied and all that stuff. And so she wasn't around a lot when I was real young. And anyway, she started getting her stuff together and, you know, got the drinking out of the way and things like that. And I was probably 10 or 11 when things started turning around. And I was walking home from school, and I lived in Franklin, Tennessee at the time. And I was standing on the side of the road, and some witnesses said that I stepped out in front of the guy, and some say that he swerved over and hit me. But either way, I got hit by a truck, and it messed me up pretty bad. I was in the hospital for a while. They called the family in and said, you know, odds of me making it were slim. And so I remember parts of it. I don't remember getting hit, but I remember like right before it, right after it. But I do remember being in an emergency room or whatever, and all of my family coming in, you know, two at a time or whatever. And I thought everybody was just coming to tell me hi, but in reality they was coming to tell me bye. But I didn't, you know, I didn't realize what was going on. I was in shock or whatever it was. And so they rushed me into surgery. I pulled through. Took a while to recover from that. And then on the day I was supposed to go back to school, I woke up and I didn't feel good. And I told my mom, I was like, you know, I don't feel good. And she just thought I just didn't want to go back to school. But come to find out, I had a blockage in my intestine. So I had to go in and get another surgery, have another surgery done. And so we did that. And but when I had the accident, it exploded my eardrum. And so from the age of 11 until 15, I had an ear infection all the time. I don't remember a time when I really didn't have one. It wasn't painful. It just had like drainage and stuff in it. There was times it was painful, but for the most part, it was just a matter of drainage. And then a doctor figured out what was going on and said that I had an infection in my mastoid, which is basically the bone behind your ear. And so he said, the way to fix that is to go in there and drain it out. So it's a pretty invasive surgery. You know, I had to drill into that bone or whatever. And when it was over with, he gave me a narcotic pain pill. At that time, it was called Vicodin ES, which was basically just like a Lortab 7.5 or what have you. And at first, I wouldn't take them. And I was sitting there with this older woman, and she's like, you know, you're in all that pain. You need to take that pill. And then I took it, and man, I just felt like, man, I finally found something. But see, at that time, I was already drinking and smoking weed. I mean, I started smoking weed at like 9 years old, not all the time, but by the age of 11, I was getting high very regularly, smoking pot as much as I could. And, so whenever that pill come into the picture, I took it, I thought, man, I really found something here. And so, when that prescription was over, I remembered, I was like, man, I want some more of them pills, and didn't have a way. And so we had like a family doctor guy, but, and the truth is, he wasn't even a doctor. He's a PAC. And so he could, you know, like see you and stuff like that. But another doctor had to sign the prescriptions basically or whatever. And so anyway, I went in there and was telling him I was having headaches. And at this time, my mother had went back to school, got an education, did some college stuff, and was doing like data processing and some kind of computer stuff. And so life was pretty good, you know, better than it definitely was in my young life. So my mom worked hard, man, and to do her thing and got that going. And so she had really good insurance. And so this doctor was giving me any kind of anything I wanted for pain, man. Was he doing it, you know, just to get money or this, that, and other? I don't know. But I know that, man, there was times when we could call him and say, hey, you know, I was out of medicine. Or I think he was, I know he was giving my mother pain medicine too. And we could say we was out, and let's just say the drugstore was closed. It was a Sunday or something like that. He would get samples from his office and drive and meet us and give them to us. And then he started prescribing me something called Stadol nasal spray. And this shit was strong. It was strong enough to knock a mule down. And he was giving it to me very regularly. So I'm an addict, you know, I'm a drug addict this time, man. And I don't even realize it, you know, that I'm addicted to it, because everybody I was around, like their moms took pills and everybody, but my friends didn't, you know, like they smoked weed or whatever. And I can look back on it and remember that I know they were probably going, man, what's wrong with Dane? You know, why is he doing this with these pills? I can't say for sure that they were doing that, but more than likely, I mean, the signs were there already at that time. And when I was 15, me and a couple of my buddies, I don't even remember who all it was. There's two or three of us. We were out. It was like the night before Thanksgiving, and we had this big idea of going hunting. And I had a gun, and nobody else did. And so we decided we were going to break in some trailers in this little trailer park and try to find a gun. And we ended up doing that, and we got caught for it. And so I was put on probation and stuff. Well, while I'm on probation, I had moved and started going to another school, and I met a girl. And you know, I'm 15 or 16, whatever it was, and all in what I thought love, you know how it is when we're that age. And this girl turned out to be one of my really good friend's sister, but I didn't even know that they had a sister. She was raised by her dad's parents, her grandparents. And so I didn't know anything about her, but when I met her, she was talking about going to her mother's and wanted me to come over there, and she told me where. It was kind of a crazy deal. I was like, damn, I didn't even know, because I grew up with her brothers or whatever. And so she ended up getting pregnant. And when it happened, her grandmother was like, you need to come and get her before granddaddy finds out or whatever. And I go and get her, and me and my mom were talking about it, and we're like, what are we going to do? And it was like, we're going to have a baby. You know, we're going to do what we have to do. And then like 2 weeks into that, her uncle comes and gets her, wants to take her to dinner. But I knew what was going on. I knew she wasn't going to be back. But I did not expect the outcome. And the outcome was she decided she was going to have an abortion. And that kind of came out of nowhere. I was against it, completely against it. But, of course, I had no say in it. And so they had the abortion. But what went on during that process was we went to the same school. And they had money, and we didn't. And so they filed a restraining order on us. And so one of us couldn't go to school. So you know who it was going to be. And so they put me on homebound, which was, you know, hour and a half of school twice a week. At the time, I didn't want to go to school anyway. Wasn't no big deal. I kind of enjoyed it, actually. During that time, me and her little brother got into some more trouble. We were at this girl's house, and I was in there with the girl, and he was in there, and he had found a necklace and some earrings or something and stole it. And we both got charged for it, and I got sent away to a group home. Now, when I go to this group home, I've got the Stadol nasal spray, and they don't know what it is. And so they're just letting me have it. And I'd run out, I'd call the doctor, man, they'd give me more. And so, but then people finally, the drugstore told them, hey, you know, this stuff's pretty strong. This kid's doing, he's doing way too much of it. And so that was the beginning of the end of that. I don't really remember being like physically sick from not having it, but I remember like mentally and things like that, you know, it messed with me or whatever. And so I was at that group home for, I say about a year, but it wasn't quite a year. It's probably about 9 or 10 months. And it was in Wayne County, Tennessee. And it's actually a pretty good place. The people there were some pretty good people and stuff like that. But so I come back home, and summertime comes and a friend of mine meets some people who were doing what's called boosting. They were basically going in stores and shoplifting, and then they would have people take it back in and they'd give you half the money or a third of the money or something like that. But these people were smoking crack and doing K4s allotted, shooting them. I didn't know nothing about neither one of these things. This was all brand new to me. But remember, I'm a drug addict, especially opiates. So I started asking all these questions about this allotted, you know, what's it make you feel like? And then, you know, I found out. And so, you know, the dudes were like, oh man, you ain't never going to do this or whatever. And of course, you know, I'm wild as hell and ain't nobody going to tell me what I ain't going to do. And so I ended up, I didn't do it at first, but one day out of the blue, my mom started talking to me about what they were doing, meaning, you know, like shoplifting and stuff, and then about the drugs that they were doing. And she was kind of like, well, I'll do it. I'll make some money, which was, I mean, I just couldn't even believe it. It was like floored me. I never in a million years would have thought that my mom would say, hey, you know, I'll go and take some of this stuff back. But the reason was the K4 allotted. Because little did I know, in the 70s, my mother had done heroin. I found all this out after the fact. And so anyway, my mom starts doing these K4 allottas, and then I do it. And then it leads to us doing it together, you know, as hard as that sounds. And, you know, I've told that part of my story a lot, and I don't want my brother to hear this stuff. But if he does, you know, man, I'm sorry, but it's true. You know, I'm not going to leave this part of my story out because it's a very impacting statement there. You know, I was 17 years old and I was shooting drugs with my mother, and this went on for about 6 months, and we lost everything that we had, lost our home, pretty much come homeless. I racked up all kind of charges, was on the run. And at the age of 18, I went and got on methadone. I went to Chattanooga, Tennessee, to Volunteer Treatment Center, and got on methadone. Methadone is just a cheaper way to stay even higher than the allottas would keep you. You're drinking, it's 24-hour buzz. But I had all these charges against me. And this dude whose girlfriend was in Chattanooga or something, he needed a way to get there, and he told on me and brought the bondsman, bounty hunter. She was all in one kind of deal down there to arrest me because I had to get bond. But I talked to the lady and was like, look, let me get my stuff together. But I mean, you know, she's going to pay a bunch of money, so no fault to hers. But she comes and gets me. And this was my real first experience with withdrawal. But when I first went to jail, they were letting my mom bring the methadone up there and they were giving it to me. And then all of a sudden, what happened was, is these grown ass sissy ass men in this jail were crying and complaining because I was getting my methadone. They was in there wanting to get high and they was all jealous. And so they started complaining. So the nurse says, oh, well, we're going to have to do a 10-day detox on you. I'm not licensed to give you this methadone. And my exact reaction to her was, you don't give me shit. You know, my mom brings it up here and I get it. Well, anyway, it caused me to act out in a real bad way. And I caused myself to do a lot of hard time and stuff like that because of it, because I was going through such withdrawal from this methadone, but I didn't really know what was going on, man, because this was my first real experiences with the withdrawal. Well, I do a little bit of time. I don't remember how much, man, 3, 4, 5, 6 months or something like that. And I get out and I went right back into cocaine and wasn't doing the lottas, but was still on methadone, but living the lifestyle, just running wild and running hard, and ended up, like I said, with a bunch of charges. And I go to jail, and while I'm in jail, I had this guy that was bringing marijuana in there to me, and I ended up getting caught. And they gave me probation for all the charges I was in there on. They gave me a 10-year probation. And then they had indicted me for the weed in jail charge. And I ended up having to go back to jail for like 90 days. But when I got out, I had like 72 hours to report to a probation officer or whatever. Well, during that time in jail, my mother had moved to Texas with a guy she had met, Houston, Texas. And so the day I got out of jail, I got on an airplane and flew to Texas. And I'll never forget it. And I was coming off the airplane and I see my mom and I hug her and I said, I'm going to prison. And she's like, what? And I was like, well, I just violated my probation. And so I get down there to meet the girl, and she gets pregnant. And yes, it's a great idea, you know, but I'm eating pills at this time and eating a lot of them. I'm strung out bad, and would get off of them for a minute and then be right back on them. And had gotten a doctor's DEA number. Things were a lot different back then when it came to pills and stuff like that. And I went to the emergency room and got pills and doctor's DEA numbers on there. And my son's mother called in a prescription and we got caught. And that's how they got me too. I had a fake ID or whatever. They charged me with all that too, but they caught me. And so I know I'm going to prison. And I was able to see my son born. That was a plus, you know, that's an experience that every man should witness for their child. And if you don't, man, you're really missing out on something. It's a very special moment. But when they arrested me, he was 3 weeks old. I had a 10-year sentence. And so I go to prison. And I end up at like a very minimum security kind of camp thing. And me and another dude decided it'd be a good idea to escape. And we do. And that was an experience on its own, man. We didn't know where we was at. Turned out another dude was going to escape that same day. And so we all three take off. But the other guy, I made him go his own way immediately because I just felt like he was going to get us caught, you know, or whatever. And we take off running through these woods and we're running. And all of a sudden we come into wide open cornfields, and this is in June. So the corn's pretty high, but not high enough to really hide in. And that's all, I mean, for as far as you can see, that's all you can see is cornfields. And I'm like, man, what are we going to do? And so we see some power lines, and there's some, you know, it's always grew up, you know, the brush and stuff around it, the weeds. And so I was like, let's get in that and hide. And so we did, we got in that thick ass brush and stuff and put leaves over us. And we hear the dogs and all that, but they never get real close to us. But I could hear police radios, and then a helicopter flew over a few times, and then a little Cessna airplane with TBI on it all day long. Flew back and forth, and then it would take a break, I guess, to get fuel or whatever, and then it would come back. And we sit there, and I remember sitting there, and we took weed out of the prison with us. And so we're sitting there smoking weed, watching this airplane fly over us. And it's June, so it don't get dark close to 9 o'clock. And so it finally gets dark, and we say, you know, what are we gonna do, man? And we just picked a direction and we started walking. And we come up on a house, you know, and the motion detector lights come on or whatever. And we'd run again. And then we heard like some kicking, like sounded like somebody was kicking on the door. And then we heard police, and come to find out it was that other guy, the one I made go his own way. He got caught that night. Well, we walk all night long, and we come up to like a logging road, and we walk to the end of it, and we come up on a house. And at first it appeared to be like where the Amish would live, like just a white house. But then I saw like the electrical wires running to it from the pole, and I was like, well, it's not an Amish house. And so we go and we look, and there's just nothing in it really. There's like a bed, a chair, refrigerator. And so doors unlocked, and we go inside, and we didn't have nothing to drink or stuff all night. So we get water, open the refrigerator. There's nothing in it to eat, but it's full of beer and vodka, and there was some coffee there. So we thought it'd be a good idea to get drunk. We get drunk and pass out. Wake up in the middle of the night, and it's like, man, what are we going to do? And so we decide that we're going to go somewhere. We're going to get something to eat. And there's this creek, and it's like pretty wide, but it's deep. And across it, there's this little house, but there's a little dog out back, and it's just yap, 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 yap. And we sit there for probably 30 minutes, and I'm like, there is absolutely no way anybody is in that house, especially asleep, and hadn't come out and told that dog to shut up, you know, or whatever. And so we cross on over, knock on the door, nobody answers. And then this lady answers the door, but she pulls it open, and it's like got a chain lock on it. And she stops it there, and she looks at me, and I said, hey, not here to hurt nobody. We escaped from prison and we're hungry. She unlocks the door and says, come on in. And she ain't got nothing on but a pair of panties and a cutoff t-shirt. And I'm thinking, this is kind of strange, you know. And dude, it took off running when he heard her. So I had to go find him, come back. We go in, and I said, "Are you here by yourself?" She said, "No, my old man's in there." And so I was like, "Where?" And then I go in there, and he's just sitting on the edge of the bed smoking a cigarette. He looks up at me. And I said pretty much the same thing to him. "Hey, man, we just want something to eat." And he was really nervous, you know, and stuff. And he's like, "Heat him up some of that pizza, baby." And so she heats us up some pizza. But again, she still has not put no clothes on. And he doesn't even, he comes in there now, and he doesn't even tell her to. And he put some clothes on or whatever, because he was in his underwear at first. And then we're sitting at the kitchen table. And again, she still got on nothing but panties and a t-shirt. He never one time said, "I think you need to put some clothes on," or none of this. And so I'm like, "Man, this is weird." So I'm like, "Y'all got a phone?" It's like, "No, we ain't got no phone, no car. We just moved in." But kept saying the brother-in-law was going to be there in a little while to pick them up for work. They were painters or something like that. But kept saying he'd have some weed and this, that, and the other. And so we eat that pizza, and she says, "I got some lasagna I made if y'all want some." And man, we ain't ate in 2 days, and she broke out this lasagna, and the poor girl couldn't cook a lick. It was disgusting. I remember me and Deuce's name was Joe. We looked at each other and both thought the same thing. My God. But again, we've been there at this time about an hour, and this woman still does not have no clothes on. And she's like, "Well, y'all need some clothes." And she's bending over this box, keeps looking back at me and smiling. And Deuce's just like, nothing. And I'm just like, I'm not paying, you know, I'm not getting caught up in that. And so, and then the brother-in-law comes over. So I walk to the door with her, and I'm standing behind the door, and she's telling him. And then he comes in, and he's apparently had some weed plants or something growing and had topped them or whatever. He's got a big old bag of some little buds and stuff. And we sit there and we smoked some more pot, and I got paranoid as paranoid could be. And anyway, the dude ended up giving us some money, some clothes, some food, and we leave. And something told me, something said, "Man, they're gonna tell on us." And I told dude that, and he's like, "Nah, we'll just continue." I was like, "No, we need to double back. We need to go back the other way." And we didn't do it, you know, didn't listen to my intuition, you know. And we went on, and we're in these thick ass woods. We kind of know the direction that we're going. And it was later that night. We're on like a little Chuck Rock road, you know, or whatever. And people lived out in the country know what I'm talking about. And we're walking and see headlights coming, and we're just able to get off the side of the road. And it's kind of like an uphill climb, or we're right at the side. So we get up around, and now we're up above everything. And as it goes by, we see it's a prison van. And I said, "Man, what's the odds of that?" You know, and I was like, "See, them people done told it." So they're back out looking for us again. And we're up on this ridge, and down below us is a house down there. And this truck comes pulling in, and a little boy comes running out, and he said, "Hey, them motherfuckers that escaped are in the area." And I'm about it. Pow! Fires a gun. I hear a bullet whiz by my head into the woods. And now I'm trying to get down in the morning. He fires off a couple more times. Pow! Pow! And he says, "They got some food. They got some money and some clothes." And them dudes in that truck was drunk. And they said, "Well, hell, they're doing better than we are." And I was like, "Man." So we laid there all night long. And next morning comes, and we're headed down this hill, and there's a state trooper down at the end of the road. And so we're sitting there, and it's probably, I mean, hard to tell what time it was. You know, didn't have a cell phone. It's way before cell phone stuff. And this was in 1999. And all of a sudden, I hear this commotion, and I'm thinking it's the police coming. I turn and look, and it's an owl. And I mean, it gets close enough to the top of dude's head to take hairs off his head. And it just kind of swooped up the last minute and goes on. Well, anyway, the state trooper finally leaves. We cross the road. We're thirsty as hell. And there's a running creek there. And I said, "Man, I'm drinking some of this shit." And we drank that water. It looked pretty clean. And I didn't get sick from it, so it must have been all right. But we go to this barn. And it's nighttime. This truck pulls up in there, and they got dogs. And it just started drizzling rain. And the dog don't come over and alert to us. So I'm thinking they must just be like some coon hunters or something. And that's what it was. And they went hunting, and then they finally leave, and we go in this little barn, and we're sitting there, and we're pretty disgusted. You know, what are we going to do, man? And I look to my right, and there's another damn dog sitting there, and I can smell it. It didn't got sprayed by a skunk, and so it wouldn't come back at night or whatever, but it never barked at us or anything. It just sit there. And so I said, "Well, we got to go. We got to do something, man." And there were some clothes in that barn, and we changed clothes again. We take off walking, and long story short, the police around us arrest us. Well, after we had left, the dude that lived there called the police and said, that we kicked the door and all that, but all that was lies. And his old lady told him, no, that was not a lie. I mean, that's a lie. They come up, knocked on the door. I let them in. And luckily she saved us, because had that shit stuck on us, we would have never got out of the penitentiary. But it's a lie. We didn't do it. I knocked on the door. The lady let us in. We didn't rob nobody. They gave us everything, just exactly as the woman said. But kind of a side note to that is that they took us to River Bend Maximum Security. We got put on what's called Max for it. And so this was in June. We didn't hear anything about it. Well, come November, all of a sudden they tell you, you're going to court. And so he's in a different unit. I ain't talked to him. And we're going to court, and we don't know what's going on. We don't know if we're going to get charged with all that shit or what. And we walk in the courthouse, and there that girl is. And I was just like, damn. And back at that time, people could get kind of close to you and stuff. You can't do that today. But she come over, and I was like, what are you doing here? She's like, oh, I'm not here for y'all. She's like, I done divorced him. I'm married to somebody else. And I was like, damn. She's like, my old man, y'all see my old man in there? And so we're sitting in there as they're calling people's charges out. And her old man was in there for molesting his stepdaughter. Not her daughter, but his prior old lady. And I remember Joe said, we're getting holding cell with him. You know, we're going to beat the hell out of him. I said, no, we ain't. I said, we do that. Girl turned around and tell them that she wasn't lying or something. They won't never get out of penitentiary. Because back in them times, you could do that, child molesters, man, you know. And lo and behold, we're getting in the holding cell. We wouldn't have to do it anyway. Two other dudes jumped on him and beat the hell out of him, as they should. Child molesters, that's what they should get. But anyway, so I end up getting 2 more years. And on a 12-year sentence, I do 11 years and 4 months on it. I say 12 years, and it's close enough to me. I stayed pretty sober during that time. I smoked a little weed, but the last 6 years of it, I didn't do anything. I drank some homemade moonshine, you know, we make moonshine in there or whatever. But I got out, man, and couldn't get a job, and I got a job. And then I met this girl, and she had been going through a divorce or whatever, and she didn't like me smoking pot. And that's all I was doing at the time. I was working. Things were going pretty good. I was starting to get some traction under my feet, you know, or whatever. And she wanted to ride around and see where I grew up and stuff, but she didn't want me smoking no weed. And so I went to my mom and lied to her and told her somebody needs some pills, and she gave them to me. Of course, they was for me. And so I took them, and I'm off to the races again. And that girl ended up poisoning me. She was going through a divorce when we met, and we never dated or anything until after the divorce. But again, man, I've done 12 years, and you know, I was seeing a lot of girls, a lot of different girls. But me and her was not in no exclusive relationship. You know, I only see her like every other weekend or whatever, but I guess in her mind, she thought that we were. And she had been following me and stuff like that, and I didn't know it. Well, she cooked me dinner one night, and that's the sickest I've ever been in my life the next morning. I don't know what she did, but I lost like 30 pounds and all kind of stuff. And I got back on methadone, and then I started racking up a bunch more charges and stuff again. I got mixed up in some forgery stuff and got strung out on methadone and stuff really bad, but I was just buying it off the street. And went to jail, had a bad detox. They give me what's called drug court. And so I take this drug court, and I take it because a friend of mine, his name is Ryan, and he wanted me to go in there with him or whatever. And I take it, and we're in drug court. I'm working. I've been sober going on a year, you know, because I'd been in jail or whatever. And I had some more probation, you know, or whatever. So I had to complete this drug court program, or I go back to jail or whatever. And my mom gets put in the hospital, and it's little did we know she was fixing to pass away. But and that was on a Wednesday. When Friday, Ryan said something to me about wanting to do a pill. And I said, man, why would you even say that? You know? And I said, well, get me one too. And so he's supposed to get it the next morning, which is Saturday. And he comes to the drug courthouse. We lived in a drug courthouse, and it's him and a girl he had a baby with. And he can't find any pills. And then heroin gets brought up. Now, I had never done any heroin at this time, but him and his baby mama had. And he makes, I don't know how many phone calls, I'm going to say 10. It was a bunch, and nobody could get any or would sell him any. And he looked at me and he said, bro, this may be God's way of telling us we shouldn't be doing this. And his phone rang, and it was a girl. And she said, yeah, I can get some. And so we go get this heroin, and we do it. And I mean, I am messed up. I can't hold my head up. I was on the verge of overdose and didn't really realize it. I mean, I literally can't hold my head up. And so we get back to the drug courthouse and he comes in, he's kind of stalling for time. And I'm like, what's up, bro? You all right? You want me to go with you? And he said, no, I'm going to try to get Brandy to give me a little piece of ass or whatever. And so he leaves and the day passes and about 10 minutes to eight, he called me and he said, I'm at a McDonald's, man. You want something to eat? And I said, man, I'm still sick. I don't know if I can eat it, but get it. And I'll keep it for later or something. Well, we had a 9 o'clock curfew and a girl I was seeing at the time was there with me and, she has to leave. Can't come here for 9 either. So she leaves and, no, actually she stayed. That's right. Because, I couldn't get a hold of him. I called, it was getting really close to 9 or whatever. I called and first his phone just rang and rang and went to voicemail and then it went straight to voicemail. But I knew in my gut, man, I pieced it together then when he was talking about it. He was talking about getting more heroin or whatever. And, they found him in his car the next day at 1 o'clock dead. Well, this is on a Sunday. Well, the drug court people come and they're basically trying to find somebody to blame for this. And, no one knew anything about that day, but me and him and his baby mama. Now she wasn't with him when he OD'd, he had dropped her off too. He was by himself. And whoever he got the heroin with. Well, anyway, I had heroin left. And when it happened to him, I flushed what I had left down the toilet. But I had a Suboxone strip. And I took that Suboxone. And on Wednesday, my mother passed away. Thursday, drug court calls me in for a drug test. And I failed for Suboxone. And they put me in jail. They said they were putting me in jail for my own safety. And so that's Thursday night. Friday, I get called up front and the nurses strip me butt naked and start looking all over my body for needle marks and I'm not going to find one. I didn't have one. And so they don't find one then. And now I pass the drug test. And so they really have no reason to keep me in. I mean, I fell for Suboxone. You know what I'm saying? Well, they come up there talking to me saying that they had evidence to prove that I was with Ryan and all the cameras, which was all a lie. And I told him basically, fuck you. You know, you're telling a lie. And I was like, what? His funeral's today. And they're like, you're not going to his funeral. And I said, well, my mom's is tomorrow. And he's like, I don't think you're going to that one either. So they take me to the back. And then I'm back there and it's a few hours later. And this guard comes back in and he says, hey, Dane, drug court wants to see you. And for lack of better terms, I told him to suck my, you know. He's like, no, I think they're going to give you a furlough. You better go talk to them. I was like, okay. So I go up there and they tell me they're going to give me a 6-hour furlough to go to my mom's funeral. And so they give me the furlough. And of course, I don't turn myself back in. And I get with, my brother's ex-wife's brother. He's like, he used to hang commercial wallpaper and travel. And he was leaving town and going to New Orleans the next day. So I hook up with him and go to New Orleans and then we end up in Tucson, Arizona. And I'm thinking, man, I got away. You know what I mean? 3 days later, I'm in Tucson, Arizona. And I get out there and immediately start taking pills and then heroin come back into my life again, black tar heroin. There's so much heroin out there. It's so cheap. I mean, you can just get it anywhere and everywhere. It's a border town. You're 45 minutes from the border. And so I met a girl and she was a good girl. She was a Mexican Spanish girl. I was with her pretty much the whole time I was out there. Well, that dude that took me out there had missed a court date for some stuff, pretty petty stuff in Louisiana. And they was on their way. They left. I stayed out there. Of course, I was with the girl or whatever. And I wasn't going back to Tennessee, no way. And not less in handcuffs. And so he got pulled over and got arrested and then turned me in and told him where I was at. And he really didn't know exactly where I was at, but he knew the girl's phone number and that's all they needed to track me down or whatever. And they arrest me and I come back and I go back to prison. And, I did, another 6 years this time. I get out and, me and that girl talked, you know what I mean? The whole time pretty much in jail or whatever. And one of them deals and I get out and, I go to it's kind of like a halfway work camp place called Safe Harbor, the biggest joke of a program I've ever seen in my life. And anyway, I go there and while I'm there, I met a woman and her name is Beth. And unlike any other woman I've ever met in my life, We hit it off immediately, and things went very, very fast. And I left that program and moved in with her, but I started doing methamphetamines and started doing dope again and got strung out. And a lot of things went on, man, the parole officer, this, that, and the other. And so I went and tried to get on Suboxone and was on it for a little while. They catch me for a parole violation. I go back to prison, stayed sober while I was in there. I get out, come home, and immediately relapse, get back on dope. But I started a business. I couldn't get a job, man, and I started an appliance repair business and was successful overnight. I mean successful. Started making a lot of money. I had a contract with Best Buy. I bought brand new trucks, two of them. I could go on and on, but got back on dope, man, and went on a pretty bad run this time, and then violate parole again for drug tests, and I'm in jail, go through a really bad detox that I didn't think I was going to make it through, to be honest about it. That's the only one I really thought was going to take me out. I wouldn't go to medical, so they're not going to do that shit for you, no way. Take your blood pressure, give you some ibuprofen. That's not going to do anything for you, and so I wouldn't even. I just laid in the floor. I laid in the floor that time for 7 days. I'd get up to use the bathroom, and I'd go get in the hot-ass shower and go back to my cell. That's it. That's all I did. And I made it through it, got back on my feet, started exercising. Things got better. Went back to prison again and get out. Now, I'm still with Beth through all of this. She stayed with me through all of my drug use, through them two times in prison, all that. And she never gave up on me, man. She refused to give up on me. I started the appliance business again. Was pretty successful again. Had been sober for a good time. And then I went to bed one night, one man. I woke up the next day, a different man. The mental aspects of all the drug use and stuff that I had done to my body finally took a toll on me. I became suicidal for the first time ever. I was wigging out really bad. Like I'd go sit in a car by myself in a parking lot for hours, not talk to anybody, nothing. And I finally ended up going and getting some help, and thank God I did, and got that under control. And Beth was right there, man. I mean, she just refused to give up. She just wasn't going to do it, man. She just decided that she was going to stick it out. And I left one part out. And before all that happened, how I ended up sober was I had just like 3 months left on all that time that I have. And I went into jail and did it. And I got out and started my business again, was doing good, but I relapsed. And I snorted some heroin, fentanyl. It killed me. And a Metro police officer saved my life. And so that's, I got sober, and then I had the mental stuff. And then, so I went through the mental stuff, man, and I got my life together. And, but how I done all that, how I got my life together, I said all that stuff to get to the most important part, and that's God. While I was in prison, and the first time I was in there, I did 9 years in isolation, man. So 9 years of basically being locked in your bathroom, solitary confinement, for what they call max, for the escape charge. And then I had a assault with a deadly weapon on an offender, and then I had another assault after that. And you know, people might look at that and say, man, how could you do that? It's a penitentiary. You're walking around with a bunch of murderers. What are you going to do if someone, you know, is threatening your life? Hopefully you're going to try to save your life, and that's what I did. But anyway, so I did a lot of time in solitary confinement. And but I educated myself during that time. I went into prison with a seventh grade education. And it wasn't that I couldn't learn or anything like that, or I was slow. It was just I wouldn't. Come to find out, I was somewhat intelligent. And I started studying different things, and the Bible being one of them. Now, I could have spent a lot more time in it than what I did. But throughout that time, I learned quite a bit about it. And I studied somewhat in the Hebrew and the Greek and Aramaic, somewhat of deeper studies than, you know, a lot of people do. And I'm not no Bible scholar by no means, but the Bible speaks to me in a different level than it would to someone who just reads it, because there's so much we don't understand the right way because we're not understanding the meaning of the words in the Hebrew. You know, there's tools you can get, like a Strong's Concordance or whatever, that will help you and aid you and all that stuff. But anyway, you know, reading the Bible and all that and learning the Bible is great, but you got to build a relationship with God. And when I was in prison the last time, I was going to visit, and I used to pray a lot because it was a long drive for Beth, and it didn't matter where I was at. You know, she would be there, and man, she was there to see me, and she was the first one in and the last one out. And the word surrender come to me, and I was sitting there talking to her, and I said, this word surrender, I don't understand this word surrender, and I'll never forget it. She said, Dane, as smart as you are, how do you not understand the word surrender? And but it still took me a long time to grasp that. And that's surrender your everything, man. Surrender everything to God, meaning lean on him. Stop leaning on yourself. Stop looking for yourself for understandings. Lean on him, man. Give your addiction. Give everything to him. And I promise you, your life will get better. And here I am today. You know, today I have a podcast. We have a sober living home. We're getting into doing some speaking. I work the appliance business on the side. Life is great, man. I have a good life today. Mine and Beth's relationship is better than it's ever been. You know, I never in a million years would believe my marriage would be where it is, because there was a lot of rough time through that, as you can imagine. You know, this was a woman who wasn't a drug addict dealing with a drug addict, and she never gave up. But I'm gonna tell you right now, she was on her last string there at the end of it, without a doubt. There's no ins, ifs, or buts about that. It was at its end, to say the least. But we made it through it, man. And here we are today. And she works in addiction, and she's about 5 weeks away from getting her master's degree. And so things are great, man. And anyone who's out there listening, whatever you're struggling with, I promise you there's a better way and you can do it. And that's why I do these podcasts. I have different types of people on them, but most of them are stories of hope for people. There are people that have dealt with different things, man. And that's what it's all about. And I invite people on all the time who have struggled and just need a little bit of uplifting. And you just heard my story, man. And as you know, I mean, I left so much of it out and could have went into a lot deeper than what I did. But you get the gist of it. Drugs was all I did and all I knew until I found God, man. And here I am today. And, you know, I'm 48 years old, and life is better than it's ever been. It only gets better every day. And no matter who you are, I've been homeless. I've done the whole nine yards. There's a way out. I promise you that. Start with God. But if you don't have insurance and you don't have no money and these type of things, in Tennessee, there are some programs. They might not be the best of programs, man. You might not get the best amenities at them, but you won't be on the street, and they're going to help you get your life together and give you all the resources. They're not going to give you a lot of treatment and stuff there. Some of them will now. One of them is pretty bad, but you can still somewhat get your life together there. It's better than being on the street. But no matter what you're going to do, whether you're going to do NAAA, Celebrate Recovery, drug treatment, rehab, whatever, you got to start with God. You got to put God in it first, man. And I don't always do a good job of that either. You know, sometimes I'm off on my prayer life and things like that. And that's what we do. You know, we're going to stumble here or there. Just don't fall down, man. And even if you do, get back up. You know, it's okay to fall. It happens, man. But if you want a better way of life, start with God. I can promise you this. You're not ever going to have nothing strung out on dope. You can sit there and daydream all day long and think one day life's just going to turn around for me. It's not, unless you get sober. Because what's going to happen is you're either going to go to jail, prison, or you're going to die. Is that what you want? Do you want your family to get that phone call and know that you just gave up like that? You know, and think about this. This may sound kind of harsh, but if you stick a needle in your arm, or if you smoke some fentanyl or snort it and it kills you, you committed suicide. You killed yourself, whether you realize that or not. And that's the last thing that your family, your kids, or whoever get to know and understand, is that you chose that over them. Don't be that, man. We're losing so many people every day. And I want nothing more than to see people succeed. I want to hear the success stories, man. Send me an email. Send a message on my websites or whatever, my social medias. Send them to me, man. We'll get you on, tell your story. I want people to hear everyday people, man. that make it through it, because we can. You know, we see it all the time, the hashtags. We do recover. We do recover, man. You know, there's a program around here that I don't recommend him by any means. But so whenever I see that hashtag, my mind can help but think about that guy. He's a fraud. But we do recover. We do recover. I'm living proof. There's so many more people out there that in the world that we don't always hear about, man, that do too. And you can too. Just please do it, man. You know, be one of us. Be one of us that can stand on that hill and be that light for others to see, to show others, man, we can do it. Let's do it all together, man. This community of recovery is amazing. Life is amazing in it. Is life going to be all peaches and creams? No, because life is life, man. Life's going to keep moving on. The thing is, we got to feel it now because we're sober. But there's people to help you, man. You having a bad day, you'll have a phone number to call. You ain't got to call Dope Man. You know, you're basically paying somebody for you to die, for them to drive around a little fancy car, you know, until they get busted and go to jail and you have to find somebody else. But you know what I'm saying, man? Let's stop this cycle. The government don't care about you. Don't nobody else care about you, but God does. Remember that. Remember what his son did for us. You know, the 3-in-1. Remember what he did for us. He came here and lived. God came here and lived as one of us and went through all the things he went through for us. Do you know if you was the only one on earth, he'd have done it for you too? Think about that. That's pretty powerful. If you ain't never heard that, and if you have heard it, it may seem or sound kind of cliche, but it's the truth. He would have done it just for one, but he done it for us all, man. Find it and build a relationship with him. Lean on him and ask him, please take this from me. And I promise you, he will. All right, man, that's my story. We're going to keep bringing more episodes to y'all to bring hope to you. We love y'all. We thank y'all for supporting us. Continue doing so. And if you're on YouTube or whatever, please subscribe to my channel. It'll help us grow on Spotify and Apple and everywhere. We do this all on our own. We don't have no sponsors and stuff yet. You know, it's all financed by us. And all we need is for people to download it and subscribe it and send a message and tell us that you like it. And we thank y'all. And remember, God's the way. And God bless you. We love you. And God definitely loves you. And we'll see y'all next time. Y'all have a good one. This is Dane Gentry. We're standing back up.